Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series by VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, ATVSwimSpas.com, the official training vessel of six-time Ironman World Champion Dave Scott. Run Catalina, the Catalina Marathon, coming up on Saturday, March 10th. You can check that out at runcatalina.com. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, donatecaf.org. Last year, we sent out 2,448 grants, totaling $3.7 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. One of our favorite people on the planet, always excited, always dynamic. It's a young man named Billy Lister, a member of the U.S. cycling team. He was down at the Paralympics in Rio, raced three events down there. Now we are lucky enough to have him living in our fine city of San Diego. Billy, how the heck are you?
I'm doing absolutely perfect today, Bob. It is fantastic to be back home here in San Diego and back in nice 70-degree sunny weather.
Sunny weather. Where'd you grow up? Were you a New York guy?
Yeah, born and raised in New York. So I actually grew up right outside Manhattan on the North Shore of Long Island in a real small town called Cold Spring Harbor. It's a tiny little town. Grew up there, but lived in New York City after graduating from college for the better part of 12 years through most of my 20s.
So when you were 15 years old, is that when you first started having issues in terms of the doctors feeling like there was something going on?
Actually, it was me that felt something was going on.
You knew it. You knew there was something wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just a freshman in high school when I started experiencing a lot of severe debilitating headaches. You know, I was an athlete growing up. I think this is something that you can relate to and a lot of your listeners can really relate to, that, you know, when you're a kid and you get involved in team sports, you know, all you want to do is just play the next sport. You know,
right.
So no matter what time of year it is, you're always doing something. You're always active, out on the field, pushing the limits, doing everything you possibly can. And that was me. I was the all-American kid growing up, going through high school, excelled at a lot of sports. I was really good. But it was my freshman year. It was the spring of that year that I started having a lot of headaches. At the end of the day, so would come home from lacrosse practice at the time, and you know, just have absolutely debilitating migraines, even to the point where couldn't do any of my homework, couldn't eat dinner, and would basically have to just come home and go straight to sleep. And obviously, that caused a lot of concern, you know, among my parents.
Sure,
because you know, here's this 15-year-old kid; he should be, you know, going through, massive hormones and growth spurts and eating everything and, you know, all that. But I would just go straight to sleep. So there was massive concern. So that's when we started going into my doctors. And that's when the doctors started doing every test under the sun that they could think of to try and find out what was causing these massive and debilitating headaches.
Now, is one of the issues... At the time, of course, this is back in the 90s, that you can't really see what the issue is, right? From the outside, you look fine. And
100%.
Were people questioning you at all and going, oh, my God, this guy's always with the headaches. What's going on here?
Yeah, they thought I might have been dogging it for a little while just to get out of my, my chemistry homework or something.
So, but the doctors,
all of the tests were coming back negative.
Right.
They couldn't pinpoint what exactly was causing all of these massive headaches. And everything, you know, was in front of some of the best neurologists, you know, in New York at the time, out on Long Island, and none of them could figure it out. So it turned out that my pediatric physician, the guy who I had seen, he was my first doctor that I'd ever seen, you know, since I was like 3 years old. I think he was my first ever doctor visit.
Yeah.
We went and saw him, you know, kind of somewhat of an unrelated appointment, and was telling about all these issues that I was having. And he came up with the idea that maybe, just maybe, I had just a off-the-charts, historic proportion sinus infection. And that was causing all of these massive headaches. So they weren't actually, like, migraines or headaches. They were just, he thought that they possibly was just a serious sinus issue.
Huh.
So we said, all right, you know, let's, you know, give it a shot and see, you know, we can't find anything else. So the doctor said, all right, let's give it a go and see what we can find out, right? Well, the fascinating thing and the amazing part about it is that whenever you go and get a scan of your sinuses, so the doctor said, let's get an MRI of your sinuses, see what we can find out. Well, the crazy thing is that whenever you get a scan, an MRI of your sinuses,
yeah,
because of the proximity to your brainstem of where your sinuses are from a imaging perspective, a part of your brainstem always naturally shows up on an MRI scan of whenever you get it of your sinuses. And so on that scan, on that MRI, was when on the very, very, very upper left-hand corner where the brainstem was just peeking through the scan was where they saw the abnormality in my brain. And that's when I got diagnosed with the brain malformation.
And it's like, what, AVM is what they call it?
Correct. So an AVM, and that is short for an arterial venous malformation. So AVM for short. It turns out that symptoms of an AVM do not include headaches, and everything that I was experiencing from those severe debilitating migraines was just a result of just being too stressed out with too much homework and playing too many sports and just being a high school kid. But that's what got me into the doctors. That's what got me scanning. That's what got me diagnosed. And so it's by nothing short of the luck of the draw that's when how I got diagnosed. Yeah.
So then you're 16 years old and you have invasive brain surgery. It's successful.
Yeah.
But one of the complications is you've got swelling in your brain several months post-op. And could you feel that? Did you feel that there was, okay, this is still isn't quite right?
Absolutely, 100%. You know, so the interesting thing, and you kind of, you really hit it on the head just, you know, just before when you said this is in the late 90s.
Yes.
You know, so medicine is not what it is in its current state of modern medicine today. And because of the deeply recessed location of that AVM, it actually was encroaching on my brainstem. So the biggest problem that came about was that no neurologist or neurosurgeon in the entire world, not even the best neurosurgeons up at Beth Israel East in New York City, the guys who wrote the book, would go in there and operate it because, you know, your brainstem is your hardware, you know, and, you know, no doctor is going to go in there willingly to try and fix that. So the only surgery and procedure that was available to me at the time was a procedure called the gamma knife surgery. And that is essentially a procedure that takes very, very, very localized gamma rays and subjects a part of your brain to that. So individually, each ray is not dangerous or toxic or, you know, radioactive. But when all of the localized beams come together, they can target a very specific part of your brain and then treat it and inherently kill that part of your brain. So in my case, their goal was to kill that AVM and that life-threatening malformation. So that, exactly like you said, that surgery was a complete and total success. It saved my life. It removed the threat of that AVM had of bursting and bleeding and causing a massive hemorrhage and almost certain instantaneous death. But then the swelling started.
Right.
And that was just a surgical complication that not even the surgeons, not even the neurosurgeons knew about prior to the surgery. Because it was a very unproven surgery at the time. You know, they didn't really understand it. They didn't know what all the potential side effects could be. So we were kind of in very much uncharted territory. So, you know, as I was experiencing this, it was something that they said, you know, you just gotta deal with it. And I remember the first time that I noticed it was driving in the car with my mom.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was in the passenger seat, you know, just like any other kid. I think we're driving on Main Street, going to the supermarket or something like that. And sitting in the seat, and my mom's got her radio station on, and, you know, I get fed up, and I didn't want to listen to her, you know, her oldie music any longer, so I wanted to change the radio station. And sitting in the passenger seat, I reached for the radio station button with my left hand, and I went to go hit the button, and I missed. I missed the button.
What?
And you kind of think, like, you know, you're like, wow, that was kind of weird, because, you know, normally, you know, any yeah. average human being, you know, you're not going to miss when you reach for a button to try and hit it or touch it. So went back, and then I tried to hit it again, and I missed it again. And it just felt, you just kind of get this weird sensation where you're just like, well, that's odd. Like, why am I missing the button? Like, there's nothing wrong with me. And so that was the very first time that I started noticing that there was something wrong within my brain.
Mm.
That was affecting me physically and on my left-hand side.
So in July of 99, you have a stroke. So take me through that. Where were you, and did you know, okay, this is bad?
Yeah. Well, you know, so it's, the brain is an amazing, amazing, amazing piece of machinery, and something that, you know, is so fascinating to me personally, because I've lived with, you know, brain issues for half of my life.
But, yeah.
So once the doctors realized that I was experiencing this swelling as a direct complication of the surgery, you know, immediately went into intensive physical and occupational rehab. Went on a massive amount of steroids and other medication to reduce the swelling that was in my brain. All of that treatment that the doctors were doing were working. All of the therapy that I was doing in 8 hours a day inpatient rehab was working. I actually was making a full recovery and, you know, getting back to the body and the physical self that I was mitigating all of the problems that were happening because of the swelling. But then, just like you said, in June of 1999, which was exactly 1 month after my 17th birthday, my brain went through a one-of-a-kind, tremendously unique situation in that my brain was diagnosing itself, and that it saw there was this AVM, this malformation, this cluster of blood vessels that had been killed and treated and eliminated, and they were super close to my brainstem, almost encroaching on it, but they weren't serving a purpose. It was just dead blood vessels and just sitting there. So my brain said to itself, you know, this set of cluster of blood vessels, this malformation, this AVM, is just sitting there, and we don't want it in there. It's not serving a purpose anymore, and it's just dead weight. So we're going to get rid of it. So what my brain started to do, it diagnosed itself doing this, and what my brain started to do was remove that set of dead blood vessels, that AVM, from the inside of my cerebral cortex, encroaching on my brainstem, and removing it through my brain to get out to the outer parts of my cerebellum.
Wow. And that basically caused the stroke.
And that's what caused the stroke. So my brain essentially gave itself a four-week-long massive stroke.
Oh, my God. So this took 4 weeks.
Yeah. So that's the incredible thing about my case and my story.
Yeah.
Is no doctors have ever seen it before. It's the never happened, never been written before, never seen kind of thing. That as my brain was removing this set of this cluster of blood vessels through it out of my cerebral cortex. That's what was causing my stroke. So every single day as my brain moved it a little bit more, because everything that happens in your brain is done tremendously incremental. You know, there's, you know, tiny little minute changes that happen on a single day, on a minute by minute basis. So it actually was happening very, very slowly. So each time that my brain was, as it was moving it through my cerebral cortex, that's what was causing the stroke. So each day I woke up and I couldn't do something I could do the day before. First day I woke up, I remember I was typing on my keyboard, and I was a 17-year-old kid. And,
yeah.
You know, as a 17-year-old kid, you don't really make mistakes, you know, typing on a keyboard, you know, growing up in the late 90s.
Right.
And I remember I was talking on Instant Messenger, you know, to one
sure.
of my friends in high school, and, you know, we're just... You know, just chatting away, and I was just making a lot of typographical mistakes with my left hand. And then, you know, the next morning I woke up, and I wasn't able to button up my shirt. You know, I had trouble trying to tie my shoes. The day after that, I wasn't able to brush my teeth with my left hand. You know, obviously, you know, after the first initial onset, you know, I went immediately into the doctors, and they put me in the MRI scans. They did everything under the sun. And, you know, the crazy thing was that they saw what was happening, and they knew exactly what my brain was doing to itself. You know, it was something that became very evident and very clear once they saw it in the scans, and something that, wow, they'd never seen before, you know, was something that became pretty obvious what my brain was doing to itself. But there was no way to stop it.
Sure.
You know, the only surgery that they could would be to open up my head and try and remove it itself to mitigate the losses of the stroke. And that the benefits of that surgery did not outweigh the risks. And the neurologist and the neurosurgeons basically said, you know, there's a very likelihood that you're not going to wake up from that operating table. And so they really said, so I was a 17-year-old kid, and they kind of just sat me down in their room. You know, I was sitting next to my parents, and they said, you know, Billy, we're really sorry to tell you this, but you got to wait this out. Like, there's nothing we can do. There's no way we can stop it. There's no way we know when it's going to stop. There's no way we know what physical condition you're going to be in when it actually does stop. They have no idea.
How long did this go? I mean, how many days?
It lasted a full 30 days.
So every day for 30 days, you were losing a little more control on the left side.
Correct.
Wow.
Every day for 4 straight weeks, I woke up and couldn't do something I could do the day before.
How did you handle this, again, as a 17-year-old kid? I guess you can look at it one or two ways. One way is, I don't know what I'm going to be losing tomorrow, but at least I'm alive. At least,
again,
you don't know how far this thing's going to go, right? It could move from
sure.
the left side and started messing around with your right side as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, really, the doctor said, you know, one of the things they said to me was that, you know, we have no idea when it's going to stop and what physical condition you'll be left in. And the possibility of being in a wheelchair for the rest of my life was a strong possibility. Just because I wouldn't, like, the possibility of complete paralysis, complete neurological
sure.
paralysis, you know, was there was potential for that. And so, you know, they said that there is a possibility that you could end up in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. But you know, it's amazing. You know, hindsight's 20/20. And when I look at back on myself 18 years ago, you know, standing as the man that I am today, you know, looking back on my mindset and how I treated things and how I really saw myself going through it, it was amazing how I coped with it. You know, while this stroke, I mean, just to give you a sense of, I think maybe this kind of is paramount to my personality, and just, you know, is, you know, it just shows, you know, kind of where my mind goes, is that even while I was having a stroke, it was a 4-week process.
Yeah.
And the first 10 days that this was happening, I was admitted into a hospital. And, you know, under, you know, extreme supervision, monitoring, daily scans. But after about a week, and the doctors kind of diagnosed and saw what was going on in my brain, and they realized and they saw that there wasn't anything else that they could do. You know, my life wasn't being threatened. I wasn't in dire threat. You know, this wasn't going to kill me. They knew that. But it could take away all of my physical abilities. So after 10 days or so, I got discharged from the hospital because there really wasn't anything else the doctors could do. They would be able to monitor it, you know, while I was at home and everything, but they told me to go back to regular life. So I went back to school.
Sure.
While I was still having a stroke. So I went back to school, and the crazy thing was I went back to the playing field right away. You know, I didn't miss a beat. I was going to soccer practice, and I was still trying to run around. So, you know, I remember like it was yesterday, you know, the first few days, because it was progressive. So the first week, you know, it wasn't like I still was able to run and do some sort of physical activity because it hadn't fully progressed by that point. So I was able to play. I was able to run around with my teammates, not the same way that I could before. But I was able to do something. I was still able to participate. But as the next 2.5 weeks went on, you know, I never stopped. I never even thought twice about, you know, not participating, not playing sport, not being active, not being the Billy that I was before. And, you know, like I said, I remember like it was yesterday, one of the first times that my soccer coach sent us out on, you know, to do a few laps around the field. And I start running, and, you know, the group, you know, we're running as a group, it's not a hard run, and the group just starts pulling away from me, and I trip, and I fall, right on my face. And that was the trigger and the moment that I realized that, wow, I really can't do this anymore. And I remember walking back to my coach and kind of just, I think I just looked at him with just this blank face, just, you know, having no answers, no explanation, no nothing. And you know, we kind of just stood there for a while. And that was one of those poignant moments that you can, you know, really just get, you know, seared not only into your memory of your brain, but into your heart as well. And that was something that that was really when I saw that sport and activity was gone, that it was no longer in my ability.
And the coach didn't even have to exchange words. It was just through, you sort of looked at each other and both knew.
Yeah, you know, he's kind of that, like, fatherly figure, you know, where he just kind of brings you right into him and says, you know, why don't you just hang out here, you know, just stand here with us kind of thing. And I think he was standing there with the assistant coach and I just stood there and waited for the team to run around. And, you know, once they finished running, then, didn't skip a beat and, you know, just, you know, went right into the drills and, you know, continued to struggle. But, you know, that was really the turning point where, you know, I really saw that the physical ability and the body that I had previously, you know, was being taken away from me slowly. And then obviously over the next week or so, 2 weeks, you know, while this stroke fully ran its course and completed its permanent destruction of my brain and created the complete neurological paralysis on my left-hand side, then it just got worse and worse and worse from that point on.
Did the doctors know that it'll be 30 days, or was and how did How did you know it was over? How did you know? Okay, this is I can maintain this now. This is could the doctor. Did they have any clue?
Oh yeah, so they had no clue how long it was going to take. You know, it was something that was completely unpredictable. There was no way that they could say how long that this could take because. You know, your brain, every brain is like a fingerprint. You know, every single one is different and unique and acts in different ways. And, you know, this is something that is not in a medical book that they could, you know, rely on research or data or experience or anything. So it was, you know, they would have been taking a complete, you know, total guess. And, you know, they were too respectful of me to even try and pinpoint, you know, a timetable on it. The thing was is that I was getting scanned on a daily basis, you know, from an MRI perspective. So I was getting an MRI of my brain on a daily basis, even when I got, even after I got discharged from the hospital from an inpatient perspective. And after that 4 week, that roughly 30-day span, they one of the days they put me into the MRI machine and did a scan and they pulled me out and we went into the room, you know, with my parents, and they said, we've got some fantastic news finally, and they said it has you know, fully run its course, and they said, well, keep monitoring it and keep making sure that it doesn't move or doesn't keep you know, navigating throughout your cerebellum, but they said we think you're out of the woods now, and everything should stop or should level off and stabilize. By that point, my paralysis was pretty extreme, and I really wasn't even able to walk without the help of assistance with an AFO. You know, wasn't able to use my hand at all, couldn't wiggle my toes, you know, so the paralysis had fully taken effect and its toll by that point. But thankfully, the doctor said, yeah, you know, you're done. You're through it. You've passed the test. It's over. So, wow. So that was it.
So then did you have to go to therapy to basically relearn how to maximize what you had?
Yeah. Well, I tried.
Right.
You know, but the thing that I learned so the next 5 years plus, you know, were completely stricken with doing physical and occupational rehab on a daily basis, you know, and trying to make any sort of improvement that I possibly could. I'm somewhat of a case study on neuroplasticity, and it's an amazing asset and benefit and advantage that I have. It's just, you know, as my brain was giving itself a stroke, it just found the switch. It found the neuroplastic switch somehow, and turned that aspect of my brain on. And so I have the extreme ability to rewire things from my brain, rewire signals. So when I'm doing occupational therapy or rehab, you know, I'm able to resend signals and actually get some sort of additional benefit, you know, from that, you know, from that intense rehab. It doesn't correct the paralysis. It doesn't correct the permanent damage to my brain. But I can get some function back if I'm doing something every single day. But the finicky thing about neuroplasticity is that it's peaks and valleys. So you can work for an entire 12-month span every single day and get the most marginal amount of gain and the tiniest little bit, sliver of functionality back. But if you stop doing that for a few days at the most, a week or whatever, it regresses 10 times as fast and you go right back to square one instantly.
Wow. So as a young guy who was athletic across the board, how did you replace that? Did you stay in sport Or was that something you said, okay,
no,
I've got to focus in another direction?
Not at all.
Yeah.
So I graduated from high school, mm-hmm. And went away to college. And once I went away to college, I developed every coping mechanism that you could possibly think of. And from, depression to hating my body, to destroying my body, became very addicted to alcohol, and was an extreme drug abuser mm-hmm. through college, because I did not want the physical body that I was living in.
Right.
I was ashamed of it.
Yeah.
I didn't want it, and I just wanted to destroy. I didn't care if I destroyed it, because it wasn't me. My physical body was not me. I knew that my mind was still in there. I knew that my heart was still in there. But the physical body that was carrying around everything else, that was me, that was Billy, was not what I wanted. And I didn't care what I did to it any longer. So I really, for the better part of 12 years, really from when I was 17 years old all the way until I was 29, just survived every single day through life, just clinging on by a thread, just trying to figure out life, with this new body and with my disability. And it was a massive struggle. It was something that was really, really hard to get through.
So when you came to the paratriathlon camp at CAF in 2011, was that the first time you'd been on a bike since your
yep.
stroke? Since you were 17 years old?
It was the first time I even knew that disabled and adaptive sports existed.
Really? So the doctors, nobody ever said, hey, there's this thing called the Paralympics. There's nothing.
No. Didn't even know. I had no idea what the Paralympics was before coming to San Diego for that paratriathlon camp.
And what got you there? What got you to that camp? Because it sounds like you were pretty far away from going to some triathlon camp.
Very much so. Interesting because on the surface of things, everything wasn't complete doom and gloom for me through those 12 years. So I did go on to graduate from college. I got my bachelor's degree. And at that point, I did what every 23-year-old white male from Long Island does or from the tri-state area. And that's move to New York City and get a job down in finance and down on Wall Street.
Yep. Yeah.
So for the next 10 years or so, I got a job down on Wall Street and, worked my way all the way up to be an executive at a financial firm, at a commodities trading company down on Wall Street. And so on the surface of things, my life was successful.
Sure.
I had a good career. I was making money. I had a lot of things going for me. But I wasn't happy. I wasn't pleased with my life. I didn't have any purpose to it. And then I forget how I actually got introduced to them. I think I found them online. But I heard about this organization called No Barriers USA,
mm-hmm.
Which is an organization based out of Golden, Colorado. They're based out of Fort Collins, Colorado, and they're an organization mostly that revolves around outdoor activity and more adventure and experiential type purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a summit once a summer, once every other summer. And I heard about their summit that they were doing down in Miami. So this was kind of the first thing I'd ever heard about any sort of adaptive sport or even, any sort of activity for individuals with disabilities. So that was my first whim. That was my first commitment, getting out of my comfort zone, kind of getting out of that deep, dark, place that I was in, mentally speaking and emotionally speaking, and really put myself out there. So I bought a plane ticket down to Miami, and I went down to this summit. And I remember, I think that was actually the first time I'd actually even met another person with a disability.
Wow!
Because up until then, I just wasn't exposed. I was living, in New York, which is, a tremendously a tremendous city for adaptive sport and athletics, but I just was not in that community, and I didn't know anybody in it either. So I think that was that weekend was the first time I even knew that other people in the world had disabilities, because I'd kind of created this world for myself that I was living in, that I was the only one in it, that I was the only person who was suffering from a disability, and I was the only person who was afflicted by something like this, and that there was no possibility that there were millions of other people across the globe who were going through very similar afflictions and times in their life. That thought and that concept never crossed my mind. Just from a perceptual perspective, I just didn't know. You know, you didn't know that there's a whole other world out there. So in Miami at the No Barriers Summit was when I met Jill Pritchard for the very first time.
Ah, from CAF.
And Jill Pritchard is one of the, she used to work in the programs department for the Challenged Athlete Foundation. And she was running a booth for CAF at this No Barriers Summit. So I met Jill for the very first time, and, you know, we really, you know, nothing, you know, it wasn't, you know, it was kind of a whirlwind of a weekend, and, you know, I don't really remember a heck of a lot, you know, from everything that I did and met there that weekend, but I remember getting Jill's information. So shortly after going back to New York, she connected me with Travis Ricks. And
yep, from CAF,
that's
yeah.
when the conversation started, that CAF, talking more about Challenge Athletes Foundation and what you guys, and what CAF has, to do and, you know, just the opportunities and everything that are out there. And that's when Travis invited me out to the paratriathlon camp in San Diego.
So when you got here for the paratriathlon camp and they said, hey, we're going to put you on a bicycle, what were you thinking?
Well, so I'll even backtrack just a few days prior to that was, I remember the exact, so, you know, Travis and I are great buddies, and
right.
I love the guy more than life itself, because he was the one who, you know, his email was the one that is seared into my brain. Because he, you know, I remember the exchange literally like it was yesterday. He invites me to the paratriathlon camp and said, you know, Billy, we'd love to fly you out. We'll get you a plane ticket. We got hotels, everything, all that. And I reply back to him, and you know, I'll caveat with this that, you know, I didn't have the personality that I have today back then. You know, I was still tremendously insecure, and you know, still trying to figure things out. And I really didn't have the strength to just jump into things at that time in my life. So I was very hesitant and had a lot of trepidation. But I go back to Travis. I reply back to him. I said, Travis, you know, thank you so much. You know, I've read about the Challenge Athletes Foundation. You guys are doing amazing work, and I'd love to be involved. But I don't know how to swim. I don't own a bike. And I don't know how to run.
Perfect.
And I'm pretty sure those are three things that you need to participate in any sort of paratriathlon.
And what did Travis say?
And his response literally was, it was just one line, one sentence, said, doesn't matter, Billy, we'll figure it out, just get out here.
I love it.
And that was it.
That's true, yeah.
And that was it. And those, that one line email was what changed my life. Because, you know, that showed me that it doesn't matter. Nobody cares. It makes no difference whether or not you have done it or whether you can or can't do it. And, you know, that was kind of the first transformation of my mindset, to that ability, of still being an active person with a disability. So fly out to San Diego, get out there for the paratriathlon camp. It was, it was pretty amazing because, you know, it turns out that, you know, I got to meet, you know, some, you know, other athletes who till this day are some of my best friends. I remember that was Haley Denishevitz's first para triathlon camp as well.
Yep.
She was just getting into the sport at the same time. And, you know, got to meet some amazing people. And because of my, I guess you can say, my physical ability at the time, which was zero, I really didn't participate in all that much. You know, got into the pool with the adaptive swimming.
Yep.
On the first day, and started to learn how to swim with
Alan
with
Voisard.
Started to learn with Alan a little bit, and, you know, really took to that. And I was like, this is awesome. This is great. Amazing. And then, you know, we went into, we were at DJJ at headquarters, at CAF headquarters, and we're on the treadmill, with Mark Sortino, and Mark is kind of showing everybody how to run on a treadmill, and I'm kind of figuring out a little bit, you know, how to run. This is literally the first time I'm also running for the first time since I was 17 years old, and swimming. And then we kind of come to the last day, it was the second to last day, I'll say that. The whole group was going out for a bike ride.
Yep.
And we were going out on the open roads of San Diego. And Roy Perkins, who is the old director of CAF programs, who is also a very good friend, one of the greatest individuals in the history of the world.
No question.
Comes up to me and says, Billy, you know, I know how badly you want to get out on the road and ride. He's like, but I just don't think it's safe for you to go out on the road with the group and ride. He's like, why don't you hop in the van with me? We're going to drive around. We're going to support everybody. He's like, you'll have a great experience, and, you know, we'll just kind of drive around, and you'll see everything. I was like, yeah, man, absolutely. I was like, because at that time I was up for anything. I was like, I'm sold. Let's go. Let's hop. So we jumped in the car, drove around, kind of did a sag for the ride, and, you know, it was a really special, that was a really special day. That was the very beginning of my personal special connection that I had with Roy that weekend. And, you know, we kind of just, you know, drove around in the car and, you know, never thought twice about it. And so, you know, we wrapped up that day. And then, you know, the following day was the final day of the camp. And so we're kind of, everything is wrapping up, and, you know, we're closing down the weekend, and everybody's starting to say their goodbyes, and I'm sitting at one of the tables in the gym at CAF.
Yeah.
And, you know, I muster up the courage to get up, and this took a lot for me at the time, to get up and go and talk to Roy and said, Roy, you know, I'd really like to get on a bike before I leave. You know, I think, you know, it's really something I want to do. So he's like, okay. He's like, let's do it right now. And I was like, well, wait, like right now? And he's like, yeah, let's do it. He's like, let's go. I was like, well, I was like, I want to get on a bike, but, you know, let's think about this kind of thing. Like, and I'm like, oh crap, this guy's actually going to do it. Like, kind of thing. Like, oh man, now I gotta sleep in the bed that I just made. So, Roy actually, so there were two bikes that were in CAF in the offices at the time. It was Roy's Cervelo P5 TT bike, which he was out there riding around. And so he offered his bike to me.
Right.
Unfortunately, it was kind of the wrong size.
Yeah.
So what we saw was that Travis's Felt TT bike was also in the offices. So, you know, Travis and I were kind of more similar sizing. And Travis was like, yeah, I take this bike. He's like, I don't use it anyway. So just go out and ride it. So grab the bike. We go out the back door of CAF headquarters, and it's just me and Roy at this time. Everybody else is inside, you know, kind of saying their goodbyes and packing everything up. So it's just the two of us, you know. We didn't make a big deal of it. We didn't do anything. It was just us two. And we go out in the back. And Roy just goes to me and says, all right, you know, hop on. You know, throw your leg over. And I said, well, what am I supposed to do? He said, just hop over your, you know, throw your leg over and, you know, we'll figure it out. So I tossed my leg over to the side of the bike, put my butt on the saddle, and Roy's holding it. And so all of a sudden he says, start pedaling. So I start moving. Yeah. And, you know, we're in the back. So we're in the back of
the parking lot. Yeah, yeah.
Of CAF headquarters. And so, you know, the parking lot like the back of your hand. So we're in the very back and we make that first right. So now we're going along the side of CAF in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, before I realize it, I'm riding a bike. And we make that next right. So now we're kind of going to the front of the office.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, you know, literally these words are just etched into my mind and memory for the rest of my life. Is Roy just goes to me, he goes, I'm not holding on anymore. You're riding a bike on your own.
Wow.
And at that moment, I realized that I was riding a bike by myself for the first time in 12 years since my stroke. And since that four-week-long episode that I had when I was 17 years old, and I was just going around the parking lot of CAF. So I ended up, you know, going a little bit more, you know, made the next right turn, going down the side. And at this point, then I'm just like, holy crap. Like, it was the mixture of pure, like, the absolute unforgettable, unrelenting joy that a five-year-old kid has when he learns, when he gets on a bike for the very first time, and that feeling of just absolute freedom and just that, you know, you're on a bike and you're doing something that is incredible that you never thought could have been possible just earlier that morning. And then you mix that with the emotion that, holy crap, like, I'm on a riding a bike and I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to stop. I don't know how to steer. I don't know how to change gears. I don't know how to do anything. So, you know, come around, you know, make the next turn to get to the back of CAF. And Roy is standing there just waiting for me. And he's just got the biggest grin on his face, just ear to ear. And it's just unbelievable. And I go, I don't know how to stop. And I didn't even know how to use the brakes.
Sure. Because
it was such a foreign concept to me. I didn't even know how to use the brakes. So I kind of just stopped pedaling and just pull in. And Roy kind of just catches me as I pull in. And that was that. And that was, you know, that was the moment. That was the time where the light switch got turned on.
And you knew. So when you went home, did the next step become, okay, I got to get one of these bikes?
Oh, instantly.
Yeah.
I think I ordered a bike on the plane ride home. And, you know, I got the crappiest bike you could possibly think of. It was a Volano Forza aluminum bike. You know, I think it came over from China, you know, from one of those China bike internet companies where you literally spent like $150 on the bike. And I was like, you know, I'm going to beat this thing to high heck. And I just want to get a bike just to learn on, right?
Sure.
So I get that bike and, you know, build it up back in New York. So I'm still living in New York City at the time. And, you know, so I get back, and that's when I really get connected with the Achilles International Foundation. And, you know, their riding and running group in New York. And, you know, started meeting some individuals, you know, who volunteer with them. And, you know, I remember going to Central Park and just going on the side roads of Central Park and teaching myself how to clip in and out and just figuring out how to balance. And to you know, how to ride on two wheels again, and it was absolutely fantastically phenomenal, because I mean I fell every single time I did it, every single time, every time without a doubt was going down on my side, falling on my hips, my side, my shoulders, banging things up, cutting things up, but I could care less because I was just having the absolute time of my life trying to relearn how to ride a bike.
So, look, that's 2011. You're getting on a bike for the first time, and at that point, you're sort of coming out of this doldrums, And then you're realizing, you know what, I can ride a bike, and I'm sure that leads to I can pretty much do anything I want to do. Was that the point where you started accepting your body and accepting who you were again?
So I'll tell you the exact moment that I started accepting who I was, and it was another revelation from CAF.
Yeah.
And that was when I did the Million Dollar Challenge for the first time in 2012.
So just a year later, you did the Million Dollar Challenge?
In 13 months later, so I figured what better way to celebrate my one-year anniversary of getting on a bike for the very first time than riding down the entire coast of California at 620 miles on my bike.
Seven days.
That's what I did.
Wow. So meanwhile, you're riding with, there's fast guys, there's challenged athletes, there's hand cycles. You sort of have a myriad of people on two wheels during that experience.
Oh, absolutely. And I didn't know a single person there. So, I didn't know anybody, outside of the few people that came from New York at the time, who we kind of had a little bit of a riding group together, but very small. Didn't know anybody, didn't know what I was getting myself into, and learned very quickly that I got myself in way over my head. But it didn't matter because, I wasn't moving fast. I was probably averaging, 11, 12 miles an hour, at the time, over the course of a ride, in just between, riding and stop, having to stop
sure.
and reposition, because I was still learning my body. I was still learning how to ride, from a balance perspective. Also how do I, position, how do I put my hand on handlebars? How do I grip myself? How do I steer? So pretty much I was learning all of this on the MDC as we were going down the coast of California. And to give you an idea, just to give you a sense, every single day on the Million Dollar Challenge was a PR for me in terms of mileage. So the first day was a PR. We did, 80
miles?
Yeah, 80 something miles. So that was a PR. Never done that in mileage before in my entire life. Second day, I think we did, it was like 89. So that was another PR. And I was able to finish like just by the skin of my teeth on those first 2 days. So then really
Big
when
sir.
Really when I started to really, dig deep into myself and, start to, find my life and find acceptance in my disability, were days 3 and 4 of the Million Dollar Challenge in 2012. And the reason why, those are such poignant special days is because those are the two biggest days traditionally of the ride. And those are days where you go from Big Sur to Pismo Beach and then on to Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
So there's some big, epic, epic days and epic riding. And you're doing back-to-back century rides.
Yes.
And for someone who already was doing PRs of 80 miles, just 2 days prior, those were pretty, massive undertakings to get to, right?
Absolutely.
So I was in beyond over my head. But I had some of the best people ride next to me and guys like, Scott Rhodes and Mike McGregor, who were just shepherding me down, down the coast. And basically just, we were just going 1 mile at a time. And, we were just, taking it as it comes and taking a lot of breaks and just going. So day 3 comes, and it's going to be my first century. And, obviously when I was traveling, 12, 13 miles an hour averaging over the course of the day, one of the biggest problems that you come across is you run out of daylight.
Yeah, it gets
dark.
You
run out of sunlight.
You got to start early.
Even to complete, 80 miles, in a day, like I was on a bike for 9-10 hours, to complete a 100-mile day, I was on a bike for 12-13 hours, So start off literally at sunrise, so before everybody goes out, starting at sunrise, and on the third day where I think it was, It was 114 miles that day.
Yep.
I get to 108. Make it to 108 miles. Just a massive, massive, massive day. And I end up getting pulled off the road.
Because it got
dark. Yeah, we ran out of sunlight. The NBC management team, just said, Billy, we need to take you off the road. Like, it's just not safe. Like, we should just pull you off. Like, it's only a few more miles to the end. Like, let's just be safe. And I was like, yeah, absolutely, 100%. And so, the amazing thing is that, so this is probably like 7 o'clock at night, like 7:30 at night. And, most of the riders are already, back, done, showered, eating a nice dinner. They're in
massage.
The program.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're all recovered. And I come back in, just covered in blood, dirt, sweat, still with my jersey, and just like blow open the doors to the dining room. And just absolutely unbelievable. So that was the third day. And that was kind of my first, that was really when I started to really see what I had, inside for the first time, because I'd never pushed my limit that hard before. So then we get to the next day, day four. And day four, I think it was 121 miles, something like that, around there.
Yeah.
And again, same exact story. I'm up against, daylight and sunlight and missing out on it. And so we're riding and get to the very end of the day, and it's getting late. It's getting to be dusk, and it's getting dark. And we're actually now, so we'd have passed the century mark. So again, back-to-back centuries, amazing, incredible. And I remember I was on the side of the road, and I got pulled over at 106.5 at 106 and a half miles. And I got pulled over by the medical staff. So it was Dr. Jeff and Nurse Sharon.
Right.
They were
in
the stag wagon.
Yep.
So they asked to pull me over, and they say, Billy, it's pitch black out right now. We have to pull you off the side of the road. This is way too dangerous. We can't do this. And I said, I can't do that. And they said, we have to. And I said, I'm at 106.5 miles. I need to get two more miles in before I stop. And they say, well, what do you mean? Like, what is two more miles going to possibly, what could two more miles possibly do for you in this magnitude of, these epic days? And I said, two more miles will get me 108.5 miles. And that's a half a mile more than I did yesterday. And those are my exact words to them. And they look at each other, and they look at me, and they said, okay. So they got in the medical van behind me, turned on the brights, and we're on the side of the road at this point. They're in the bike lane with the brights on, and we ride for another, I don't even know how long it took me to go 2 miles, another 15, 20 minutes or so, do exactly two more miles, get to 108.5, and I hop off my bike at that point, and get into the van and drive home. And, those days were when I really started to find my ability with my disability, that I started to realize that I could still push myself as hard athletically, emotionally, mentally, every possible way that I did when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, on all those athletic fields, the same exact way, and if not even more, with this body that I have. And, those limits that I was reaching and massively exceeding was really showing me that just because, I'm in this physical body that I hated and that I was so mad at and depressed that I had, didn't mean that it had to stop me. And that those days and that ride showed me that my body, my physical disability, would not hold me back any longer.
So when did you decide, okay, I just did $1 Million Challenge. A year ago, I learned how to ride a bike. And now I think, you know what, maybe I'll become a paracyclist and maybe go to the Paralympics. I mean, that's, you've climbed a lot of stairs in a very short period of time here.
I am a tremendously, tremendously lucky and fortunate individual. I'm the luckiest guy in the history of history because of the meteoric rise that I experienced, in my very, very short professional career so far. So it kind of started when I moved out to Orange County, California from New York City in March of 2013. Moved out there for my job, got an opportunity to move out there and work in Orange County in our offices out there. And I was living in Huntington Beach and was only a block and a half off of PCH and away from the beach. Just absolutely perfect place to live. So I started riding my bike a lot more. So, I literally would just roll right out of my apartment and, be on PCH in 2 minutes. And, you could just ride PCH forever through Huntington and Laguna and Newport Beach, and just started riding more and more on a daily basis. And that kind of turned into training. And that's when I got connected, with a coach, so it's through a good buddy of mine and a great friend of the Challenge Athlete Foundation, Stephen Peace. Decorated Paralympian and Paralympic cyclist, and is one of the best guys I've ever met. He kind of introduced me to a coach, started working with a coach, and then I got introduced to U.S. Paralympic Cycling and to the high performance director and the head coach of the team, and. It was kind of just a virtual introduction, and they said, hey, Billy, it was great to meet you and everything. And, timing was pretty good. So this was at the very end of 2013 going into 2014. And they were holding a very low key time trial, in Otay Lakes in Chula Vista.
Oh yeah. By the training center out there. Yeah.
Yeah, right outside the Chula Vista Training Center. So they said, "Why don't you come down and participate?" It's just a domestic race, for just kind of the national team and local riders. But it was a great opportunity for me to get out there and to see. So, I got into the race, and so I entered the time trial. And I didn't even own a time trial bike at the time; didn't even know how to ride a time trial bike. So I entered in with my road bike, without even really still learning how to clip in and still learning how to ride, I went to the start line and just decided to go as hard as I could and, figure it out. And it turned out that I did really well. they saw that. They said, "Wow, holy heck, this kid's got a... he's got some talent and he's got some, some serious potential, to do it." And, kind of since then, I've can really say that I've been a bike racer ever since. And, that kind of led to, going into 2014, really my first real domestic race, where it was kind of a national competition, like a national championships on the road. And that's where I started to qualify for my first international race, and did my first international race the following year in 2015. And then started racing 2015. And really, that's kind of when I really fully committed in 2015. And that's when I moved to the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. So moved out of Southern California, moved away from Orange County. Went to Colorado Springs to fully commit myself and make an 18-month push to Paralympic trials in July of 2016, and see if I had it to make the Games team and to represent Team USA in Rio. And
which you did.
That was the commitment, and that was really the test to see if I had it. And it worked.
Well, so here you go. You got fifth in the road race, individual pursuit, and time trial. You had one track event and two track events and one, and then the road race. No, wait. Yeah, time trial. So what was that feeling like for opening ceremonies? Here you are really 5 years from riding a bike for the very first time since you had your stroke at the age of 17 in 1999. And now you're one of the best in the world, and you're marching, you're representing the U.S. team at the Paralympics.
It would be a complete understatement to say that it was a surreal and outer body experience. You know, it really even goes back just, just 2.5 months prior when I went to Paralympic trials in Charlotte, North Carolina, as the complete new kid on the block, dark horse, unproven. You know, kid's got some talent, but he's never done it on, a big stage before. So, who knows, coming in and seeing what he's got. And for me to go to Paralympic trials and to win and to get the overall win in the male two-wheel cyclist category, and that's what punched my ticket to Rio, and that's kind of really what did everything. That's where the surrealness of the entire experience, I guess, started, and seeing that, holy cow, like everything that I sacrificed and done and put all the hard work into over the last year and a half, has paid off. And then, it's amazing how you don't even really get a chance to think twice before, it's resetting and getting ready to compete at the games. The goal then becomes, not just representing your country, but winning on the high stage and getting a medal at the games. And so getting over to Rio was something special. It was something that I think, looking back on it, I probably didn't relish it as much as I would have liked to, just because I was so wide-eyed, and it's such an overwhelming time that you can't prepare yourself. The amount of people that you talk to realize it and to gauge it and be present in the moment, it's impossible. Once you get there, it's just the emotions and the energy and the electricity and the environment. Just it's like when a tornado meets a volcano, and it's absolute. It's of absolute magnitude, and was something pretty existential, from my level, and something that I thought just a few short years ago, would never be possible.
Of course.
Never, ever, ever in a million years could I have envisioned myself competing on the highest stage in athletics, representing my country, representing our country in the United States of America. Being there, I mean, it was there. There's no way that just even 4 years prior, could have even think that I would have been in that position.
So here you get the White House visit, you meet President Obama, get a hug from Michelle Obama. the goal now is 2020 and potentially 2024, 2028. You are all in on this. You're living here in San Diego, and basically you're a professional athlete. You're doing the right stuff. And, I found finding out that there are 6 million people who are stroke survivors in the U.S. and, potentially 10 million by 2030. It's sort of that, maybe, not quite invisible, but it's one of those things that people don't realize that somebody has potentially had a stroke. And I don't think, like you had no idea that there were the sport was out there for you. So how important is it for you to be that role model for the next person?
Oh, dramatically. Stroke is it is one of the leading causes of disability in the United States of America. And it is not a part of people's conversations in their living rooms, in their dining rooms, in their households. And it is the fourth leading cause of death in the United States of America as well. It is up there and actually above, many forms of cancer, and just behind heart disease. And so raising awareness, you know, for stroke is something that is tremendously dear to me and an absolute commitment and a passion of mine. And then in addition to that, to help out the stroke survivor community is because, you know, I am one of the greatest things that has been afforded to me, and the greatest asset that I have is time. You know, Bob, you know, it's one of the things that I've learned is my greatest asset is that I've lived as a stroke survivor and as an individual with a disability for 18 years, for over half my life. And, you know, I get to meet, you know, so many stroke survivors who are, you know, 1 month, 6 months, 2 years, you know, 3 years, and you know, they, you know, it's really tremendously difficult. And providing help and support and guidance to that community is something that, you know, really gives me a lot of pride and tremendous amount of happiness, because, you know, if somebody had come to me when I was, you know, 25 years old, you know, maybe 21 years old, whatever it is, you know, and I'd gotten, you know, who knows, if I'd gotten a 5, 8, you know, 9-year head start, you know, to where, you know, to sport and to the mindset and the progress that I, you know, that I made, you know, starting, you know, when I was 29 years old, you know, maybe, you know, things could be, you know, could have had a very, very dramatically different life. I mean, who knows, you know, it's tremendous to think about, and you know that's what I strive to try and spread and help other individuals out.
So, when something like this happens to people, they can go with the, you know, why me? And you obviously went through that. You went through the, you know, you could have been dead, and you went through the medicating yourself through the years. But I read where you said that stroke gave me an extreme gift. What do you mean by that?
I mean, you know, first and foremost, what I mean by that is I wouldn't have the opportunity and ability to race my bike all over the world for a living, and to get to put on the red, white, and blue stars and stripes on my back and represent the United States of America all over the world, and to have that pride and sense to do that. But more so, it gave me a mindset. You know, it formed a personality inside of me that is something that I've grown to accept and to love, and, you know, something that I think if I hadn't had a stroke and my brain hadn't gone through what it went through and gotten rewired the way that it did, you know, very well may not have come out. You know, our brains are, you know, just amazing things that, you know, they can change and you can relearn things, but, you know, it doesn't happen naturally. You know, sometimes it takes an unnatural event. In my case, it was a stroke. It was an unnatural stroke for it to relearn something and use a different part of it. And if that hadn't happened, you know, maybe this, you know, this passion and happiness and joy that I have, and this excitement and zeal for life, you know, might not have been woken up if my stroke hadn't happened to me. You know, and that's not to say that I wouldn't have lived a full and enjoyable life, but, you know, I probably can definitively say that, you know, as a 35-year-old man right now, I probably, you know, if I hadn't gone through my circumstances and my stroke and my disability, and, you know, just went through a normal life, I'd probably be living somewhere in the suburbs in New Jersey, Connecticut, or New York, and, you know, commuting back and forth, you know, to New York City, you know, having a good job, you know, with a very fulfilling family, a white picket fence, and all that. You know, it would be a great life and super happy and with that. But the way that my stroke changed me is the ways that I could never replace and could never think otherwise. And having the lens that I look at life, that I look through life right now, is something that I would never give back.
ever in a million years.
And it's so cool that CAF has been part of that journey.
CAF not only has been a part of that journey, they were the start of that journey, they were the middle of that journey, and they've been everything of that journey.
Very cool.
I can unequivocally say without a shadow of a doubt that I would not be where I am today, who I am today, and what I am today without the Challenge Athlete Foundation. There is no doubt that they not only changed my life, but they saved my life. There's a lot of there was a lot of paths and possibilities that my trajectory was taking me down, and not a lot of them were positive or good. And CAF, they turned the light switch on for me. You know, it was the best metaphor that I can give you was, you know, I was a kid just standing in a completely pitch black room, you know, nothing in there, just absolute nothingness, all by myself. And all of a sudden, somebody just tapped me on the shoulder, and they said, "Hey, Billy, you know, the light switch is, it's right behind you. All you got to do is just turn it on." And that was CAF. You know, they were the ones who tapped me on the shoulder. They were the ones who showed me where the light switch is, and they were the ones who turned it on. And that changed everything.
Billy, you are the best, man. That was really a fun conversation. I apologize for taking so much of your time. I'm like,
what?
This guy is so much fun to chat with.
This is the best, man. I could talk to you like this all night long. You know that, brother.
I do know that. We'll have to get together soon, man. It was great seeing you the other day. Always fun to catch up. I'm so glad you're back. You're in San Diego. That's very cool.
It is good to be home in San Diego. That's for sure. You know, it took a little while to make it happen, but it feels perfect to be here and to be home in San Diego and now to be in and around the community and the family and the CAF family. And so you'll be seeing me a lot more all the time everywhere. Hopefully, whenever we want it.
Love it. Billy Lister has been our guest. Again, we are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, VeloFix.com, ATVSwimSpas.com, RunCatalina.com. Catalina Marathon coming up Saturday, March 10th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation last year, 2,448 grants, totaling $3.7 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville and on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here.